of anything that is more than money or commodities, or that can produce any effect beyond what money and commodities can. For me, the purchase from A and the sale to B are part of a series. But the connection between the two acts exists for me alone. A does not trouble himself about my transaction with B, nor does B about my business with A. And if I offered to explain to them the meritorious nature of my action in inverting the order of succession, they would probably point out to me that I was mistaken as to that order of succession, and that the whole transaction, instead of beginning with a purchase and ending with a sale, began, on the contrary, with a sale, and was concluded with a purchase. In truth, my first act, the purchase, was from the standpoint of A, a sale, and my second act, the sale, was from the standpoint of B, a purchase. Not content with that, A and B would declare that the whole series was superfluous, and nothing but hocus-pocus, that for the future A would buy direct from B, and B sell direct to A. Thus the whole transaction would be reduced to a single act, forming an isolated, non-complemented phase in the ordinary circulation of commodities, a mere sale from A's point of view, and from B's a mere purchase. The inversion, therefore, of the order of succession does not take us outside the sphere of the simple circulation of commodities, and we must rather look whether there is in this simple circulation anything permitting an expansion of the value that enters into circulation, and consequently a creation of surplus value. Let us take the process of circulation in a form under which it presents itself as a simple and direct exchange of commodities. This is always the case when two owners of commodities buy from each other, and on the settling day the amounts mutually owing are equal and cancel each other. The money in this case is money of account, and serves to express the value of the commodities by their prices, but is not itself in the shape of hard cash confronted with them. So far as regards use values, it is clear that both parties may gain some advantage. Both part with goods that, as use values, are of no service to them, and receive others that they can make use of. And there may also be a further gain. A, who sells wine and buys corn, possibly produces more wine with given labour time than farmer B could, and B, on the other hand, more corn than wine grower A could. A, therefore, may get for the same exchange value more corn and B more wine than each would respectively get without any exchange by producing his own corn and wine. With reference, therefore, to use value, there is good ground for saying that exchange is a transaction by which both sides gain. Footnote. Exchange is a transaction in which the two contracting parties always gain, both of them. Distut de Tracy, Traité de la Volonté et de ses Effets, Paris, 1826. It is otherwise with exchange value. A man who has plenty of wine and no corn treats with a man who has plenty of corn and no wine. An exchange takes place between them of corn to the value of 50 for wine of the same value. This act produces no increase of exchange value either for the one or the other, for each of them already possessed, before the exchange, a value equal to that which he acquired by means of that operation. Mercier de la Rivière. The result is not altered by introducing money as a medium of circulation between the commodities and making the sale and the purchase two distinct acts. Footnote. Whether one of those two values is money, or they are both ordinary commodities, is in itself a matter of complete indifference. Mercier de la Rivière. End of footnote. The value of a commodity is expressed in its price before it goes into circulation, and is therefore a precedent condition of circulation, not its result. Footnote. It is not the parties to a contract who decide on the value. That has been decided before the contract. Le Trône. End of footnote. Abstractedly considered, that is, apart from circumstances not immediately flowing from the laws of the simple circulation of commodities, there is in an exchange nothing, if we accept the replacing of one use value by another, but a metamorphosis, a mere change in the form of the commodity. The same exchange value, that is, the same quantity of incorporated social labour, remains throughout in the hands of the owner of the commodity, first in the shape of his own commodity, then in the form of the money for which he exchanged it, and lastly in the shape of the commodity he buys with that money. The change of form does not imply a change in the magnitude of the value, but the change which the value of the commodity undergoes in this process is limited to a change in its money form. This form exists first as the price of the commodity offered for sale, then as an actual sum of money, which, however, was already expressed in the price, and lastly as the price of an equivalent commodity. This change of form no more implies, taken alone, a change in the quantity of value than does the change of a £5 note into sovereigns, half-sovereigns, and shillings. So far, therefore, as the circulation of commodities effects a change in the form alone of their values and is free from disturbing influences, it must be the exchange of equivalents. Little as vulgar economy knows about the nature of value, yet whenever it wishes to consider the phenomena of circulation in their purity, it assumes that supply and demand are equal, which amounts to this: that their effect is nil. If, therefore, as regards the use values exchanged, both buyer and seller may possibly gain something, this is not the case as regards the exchange values. Here we must rather say, where equality exists, there can be no gain. It is true, commodities may be sold at prices deviating from their values, but these deviations are to be considered as infractions of the laws of the exchange of commodities, which, in its normal state, is an exchange of equivalents, consequently no method for increasing value. Footnote. The exchange becomes unfavourable for one of the parties when some external circumstance comes to lessen or increase the price. Then equality is infringed, but this infringement arises from that cause, and not from the exchange itself. Le Trône. Exchange is by its nature a contract which rests on equality, that is, it takes place between two equal values, and is not a means of self-enrichment, since as much is given as is received. Le Trône. End of footnote. Hence we see that behind all attempts to represent the circulation of commodities as a source of surplus value, there lurks a quid pro quo, a mixing up of use value and exchange value. For instance, Condillac says, it is not true that on an exchange of commodities we give value for value. On the contrary, each of the two contracting parties in every case gives a less for a greater value. If we really exchanged equal values, neither party could make a profit. And yet they both gain, or ought to gain. Why? The value of a thing consists solely in its relation to our wants. What is more to the one is less to the other, and vice versa. It is not to be assumed that we offer for sale articles required for our own consumption. We wish to part with a useless thing, in order to get one that we need. We want to give less for more. It was natural to think that, in an exchange, value was given for value, whenever each of the articles exchanged was of equal value with the same quantity of gold. But there is another point to be considered in our calculation. The question is, whether we both exchange something superfluous for something necessary. Footnote, Condillac, Le Commerce et le Gouvernement, 1776. End of footnote. We see in this passage how Condillac not only confuses use value with exchange value, but in a really childish manner assumes that in a society in which the production of commodities is well developed, each producer produces his own means of subsistence and throws into circulation only the excess over his own requirements. Footnote. Le Tron, therefore, answers his friend Condillac with justice as follows. In a developed society, absolutely nothing is superfluous. At the same time, in a bantering way, he remarks, if both the persons who exchange receive more to an equal amount and part with less to an equal amount, they both get the same. It is because Condillac has not the remotest idea of the nature of exchange value that he has been chosen by Herr Professor Wilhelm Roscher as a proper person to answer for the soundness of his own childish notions. See Roscher's Die Grundlagen der Nationalökonomie, dritte Auflage, 1858. End of footnote. Still, Condillac's argument is frequently used by modern economists, more especially when the point is to show that the exchange of commodities in its developed form, commerce, is productive of surplus value. For instance, commerce adds value to products, for the same products in the hands of consumers are worth more than in the hands of producers, and it may strictly be considered an act of production. Footnote, S. P. Newman, Elements of Political Economy, 1835. End of footnote. But commodities are not paid for twice over, once on account of their use value and again on account of their value. And though the use value of a commodity is more serviceable to the buyer than to the seller, its money form is more serviceable to the seller. Would he otherwise sell it? We might therefore just as well say that the buyer performs strictly an act of production, by converting stockings, for example, into money. If commodities, or commodities and money, of equal exchange value, and consequently equivalents, are exchanged, it is plain that no one abstracts more value from than he throws into circulation. There is no creation of surplus value. And, in its normal form, the circulation of commodities demands the exchange of equivalents. But in actual practice, the process does not retain its normal form. Let us therefore assume an exchange of non-equivalents. In any case, the market for commodities is only frequented by owners of commodities, and the power which these persons exercise over each other is no other than the power of their commodities. The material variety of these commodities is the material incentive to the act of exchange, and makes buyers and sellers mutually dependent, because none of them possesses the object of his own wants, and each holds in his hand the object of another's wants. Besides these material differences of their use values, there is only one other difference between commodities, namely, that between their bodily form and the form into which they are converted by sale, the difference between commodities and money. And consequently, the owners of commodities are distinguishable only as sellers, those who own commodities, and buyers, those who own money. Suppose, then, that by some inexplicable privilege, the seller is enabled to sell his commodities above their value. What is worth 100 for 110, in which case the price is nominally raised 10%. The seller therefore pockets a surplus value of 10. But after he has sold, he becomes a buyer. A third owner of commodities comes to him now as seller, who in this capacity also enjoys the privilege of selling his commodities 10% too dear. Our friend gained 10 as a seller, only to lose it again as buyer. Footnote. by the augmentation of the nominal value of the produce, sellers not enriched, since what they gain as sellers, they precisely expend in the quality of buyers. The Essential Principles of the Wealth of Nations, etc., London, 1797. End of footnote. The net result is that all owners of commodities sell their goods to one another at 10% above their value, which comes precisely to the same as if they sold them at their true value. Such a general and nominal rise of prices has the same effect as if the values had been expressed in weight of silver instead of in weight of gold. The nominal prices of commodities would rise, but the real relation between their values would remain unchanged. Let us make the opposite assumption, that the buyer has the privilege of purchasing commodities under their value. In this case, it is no longer necessary to bear in mind that he in his turn will become a seller. He was so before he became buyer. He had already lost 10% in selling before he gained 10% as buyer. Footnote. If one is compelled to sell a quantity of a certain product for 18 livres, when it has a value of 24 livres, when one employs the same amount of money in buying, one will receive for 18 livres the same quantity of the product as 24 livres would have bought otherwise. Le Trône. End of footnote. Everything is just as it was. The creation of surplus value, and therefore the conversion of money into capital, can consequently be explained neither on the assumption that commodities are sold above their value, nor that they are bought below their value. Footnote. A seller can normally only succeed in raising the prices of his commodities if he agrees to pay, by and large, more for the commodities of the other sellers. And for the same reason, a consumer can normally only pay less for his purchases if he submits to a similar reduction in the prices of the things he sells. Mercier de la Rivière. End of footnote. The problem is in no way simplified by introducing irrelevant matters, after the manner of Colonel Torrens. Effectual demand consists in the power and inclination on the part of consumers to give for commodities, either by immediate or circuitous barter, some greater portion of capital than their production costs. Footnote. Torrens. An Essay on the Production of Wealth. London, 1821. End of footnote. In relation to circulation, producers and consumers meet only as buyers and sellers. To assert that the surplus value acquired by the producer has its origin in the fact that consumers pay for commodities more than their value is only to say, in other words, the owner of commodities possesses, as a seller, the privilege of selling too dear. The seller has himself produced the commodities or represents their producer, but the buyer has to no less extent produced the commodities represented by his money, or represents their producer. The distinction between them is that one buys and the other sells. The fact that the owner of the commodities under the designation of producer sells them over their value, and under the designation of consumer pays too much for them, does not carry us a single step further. Footnote. The idea of profits being paid by the consumers is assuredly very absurd. Who are the consumers? G. Ramsay, An Essay on the Distribution of Wealth, Edinburgh, 1836. End of footnote. To be consistent, therefore, the upholders of the delusion that surplus value has its origin in a nominal rise of prices or in the privilege which the seller has of selling too dear must assume the existence of a class that only buys and does not sell, that is, only consumes and does not produce. The existence of such a class is inexplicable from the standpoint we have so far reached, viz., that of simple circulation. But let us anticipate. The money with which such a class is constantly making purchases must constantly flow into their pockets without any exchange, gratis, by might or right, from the pockets of the commodity owners themselves. To sell commodities above their value to such a class is only to crib back again a part of the money previously given to it. Footnote. When a man is in want of a demand, does Mr. Malthus recommend him to pay some other person to take off his goods? Is a question put by an angry disciple of Ricardo to Malthus, who, like his disciple Parson Chalmers, economically glorifies this class of simple buyers or consumers. See, an inquiry into those principles respecting the nature of demand and the necessity of consumption, lately advocated by Mr. Malthus, etc., 1821, end of footnote. The towns of Asia Minor thus paid a yearly money tribute to ancient Rome. With this money, Rome purchased from them commodities and purchased them too dear. The provincials cheated the Romans, and thus got back from their conquerors in the course of trade a portion of the tribute. Yet, for all that, the conquered were the really cheated. Their goods were still paid for with their own money. That is not the way to get rich or to create surplus value. Let us therefore keep within the bounds of exchange where sellers are also buyers and buyers sellers. Our difficulty may perhaps have arisen from treating the actors as personifications instead of as individuals. A may be clever enough to get the advantage of B or C without their being able to retaliate. A sells wine worth £40 to B, and obtains from him, in exchange, corn to the value of £50. A has converted his £40 into £50, has made more money out of less, and has converted his commodities into capital. Let us examine this a little more closely. Before the exchange, we had £40 worth of wine in the hands of A, and £50 worth of corn in those of B, a total of £90. After the exchange, we have still the same total value of £90. The value in circulation has not increased by one iota. It is only distributed differently between A and B. What is a loss of value to B is surplus value to A. What is minus to one is plus to the other. The same change would have taken place if A, without the formality of an exchange, had directly stolen the £10 from B. The sum of the values in circulation can clearly not be augmented by any change in their distribution, any more than the quantity of the precious metals in a country, by a Jew selling a Queen Anne's farthing for a guinea. The capitalist class, as a whole, in any country, cannot overreach themselves. Footnote. Destutt de Tracy, although, or perhaps because, he was a member of the Institute, held the opposite view. He says, industrial capitalists make profits because they all sell for more than it has cost to produce. And to whom do they sell? In the first instance, to one another. End of footnote. Turn and twist, then, as we may, the fact remains unaltered. If equivalents are exchanged, no surplus value results, and if non-equivalents are exchanged, still no surplus value. Footnote. The exchange of two equal values neither increases nor diminishes the amount of the values available in society, nor does the exchange of two unequal values change anything in the sum of social values, although it adds to the wealth of one person what it removes from the wealth of another. J.B. Say. Say, not in the least troubled as to the consequences of this statement, borrows it, almost word for word, from the physiocrats. The following example will show how Monsieur Say turned to account the writings of the physiocrats, in his day quite forgotten, for the purpose of expanding the value of his own. His most celebrated saying, products can only be bought with products, runs as follows in the original physiocratic work. Products can only be paid for with products. Le trône. End of footnote. Circulation, or the exchange of commodities, begets no value. Footnote. Exchange confers no value at all upon products. F. Weyland, The Elements of Political Economy, Boston, 1843. End of footnote. The reason is now therefore plain why, in analysing the standard form of capital, the form under which it determines the economic organisation of modern society, we entirely left out of consideration its most popular and, so to say, antediluvian forms, merchants' capital and moneylenders' capital. The circuit, money to commodity to money, buying in order to sell dearer, is seen most clearly in genuine merchants' capital. But the movement takes place entirely within the sphere of circulation. Since, however, it is impossible, by circulation alone, to account for the conversion of money into capital, for the formation of surplus value, it would appear that merchants' capital is an impossibility, so long as equivalents are exchanged. That, therefore, it can only have its origin in the twofold advantage gained over both the selling and the buying producers, by the merchant who parasitically shoves himself in between them. Footnote. Under the rule of invariable equivalence, commerce would be impossible. G. Opdyke, A Treatise on Political Economy, New York, 1851. The difference between real value and exchange value is based upon this fact, namely, that the value of a thing is different from the so-called equivalent given for it in trade. That is, that this equivalent is no equivalent. Friedrich Engels. End of footnote. It is in this sense that Franklin says, war is robbery, commerce is generally cheating. Footnote. Benjamin Franklin. Positions to be examined concerning national wealth. End of footnote. If the transformation of merchants' money into capital is to be explained otherwise than by the producers being simply cheated, a long series of intermediate steps would be necessary, which, at present, when the simple circulation of commodities forms our only assumption, are entirely wanting. What we have said with reference to merchants' capital applies still more to moneylenders' capital. In merchants' capital, the two extremes, the money that is thrown upon the market and the augmented money that is withdrawn from the market, are at least connected by a purchase and a sale, in other words, by the movement of the circulation. In moneylenders' capital, the form money to commodity to money is reduced to the two extremes without a mean. Money to money, money exchanged for more money, a form that is incompatible with the nature of money, and therefore remains inexplicable from the standpoint of the circulation of commodities. Hence Aristotle. Since crematistic is a double science, one part belonging to commerce, the other to economic, the latter being necessary and praiseworthy, the former based on circulation and with justice disapproved, for it is not based on nature but on mutual cheating, therefore the usurer is most rightly hated, because money itself is the source of his gain, and is not used for the purposes for which it was invented. For it originated for the exchange of commodities, but interest makes out of money more money. Hence its name, Tokos, Interest and Offspring. For the begotten are like those who beget them, but interest is money of money, so that of all modes of making a living, this is the most contrary to nature. Aristotle. In the course of our investigation, we shall find that both merchants' capital and interest-bearing capital are derivative forms, and at the same time it will become clear why these two forms appear in the course of history before the modern standard form of capital. We have shown that surplus value cannot be created by circulation, and therefore that in its formation something must take place in the background, which is not apparent in the circulation itself. Footnote. Profit, in the usual condition of the market, is not made by exchanging. Had it not existed before, neither could it after that transaction. Ramsay. End of footnote. But can surplus value possibly originate anywhere else than in circulation, which is the sum total of all the mutual relations of commodity owners, as far as they are determined by their commodities? Apart from circulation, the commodity owner is in relation only with his own commodity. So far as regards value, that relation is limited to this, that the commodity contains a quantity of his own labour, that quantity being measured by a definite social standard. This quantity is expressed by the value of the commodity, and since the value is reckoned in money of account, this quantity is also expressed by the price, which we will suppose to be £10. But his labour is not represented both by the value of the commodity and by a surplus over that value, not by a price of £10 that is also a price of 11, not by a value that is greater than itself. The commodity owner can, by his labour, create value, but not self-expanding value. He can increase the value of his commodity by adding fresh labour and therefore more value to the value in hand, by making, for instance, leather into boots. The same material has now more value because it contains a greater quantity of labour. The boots have therefore more value than the leather, but the value of the leather remains what it was. It has not expanded itself, has not, during the making of the boots, annexed surplus value. It is therefore impossible that outside the sphere of circulation, a producer of commodities can, without coming into contact with other commodity owners, expand value, and consequently convert money or commodities into capital. It is therefore impossible for capital to be produced by circulation, and it is equally impossible for it to originate apart from circulation. It must have its origin both in circulation and yet not in circulation. We have, therefore, got a double result. The conversion of money into capital has to be explained on the basis of the laws that regulate the exchange of commodities, in such a way that the starting point is the exchange of equivalents. Footnote. From the foregoing investigation, the reader will see that this statement only means that the formation of capital must be possible even though the price and value of a commodity be the same, for its formation cannot be attributed to any deviation of the one from the other. If prices actually differ from values, we must, first of all, reduce the former to the latter. In other words, treat the difference as accidental, in order that the phenomena may be observed in their purity, and our observations not interfered with by disturbing circumstances that have nothing to do with the process in question. We know, moreover, that this reduction is no mere scientific process. The continual oscillations in prices, their rising and falling, compensate each other and reduce themselves to an average price, which is their hidden regulator. It forms the guiding star of the merchant or the manufacturer in every undertaking that requires time. He knows that when a long period of time is taken, commodities are sold neither over nor under, but at their average price. If, therefore, he thought about the matter at all, he would formulate the problem of the formation of capital as follows. How can we account for the origin of capital on the supposition that prices are regulated by the average price, that is, ultimately by the value of the commodities? I say ultimately, because average prices do not directly coincide with the values of commodities, as Adam Smith, Ricardo and others believe. End of footnote. Our friend Moneybags, who as yet is only an embryo capitalist, must buy his commodities at their value, must sell them at their value, and yet at the end of the process must withdraw more value from circulation than he threw into it at starting. His development into a full-grown capitalist must take place both within the sphere of circulation and without it. These are the conditions of the problem. Hic Rhodus, hic salta. Chapter 6. The Buying and Selling of Labour Power. The change of value that occurs in the case of money intended to be converted into capital cannot take place in the money itself, since in its function of means of purchase and of payment, it does no more than realize the price of the commodity it buys or pays for, and as hard cash, it is value petrified, never varying. Footnote. In the form of money, capital is productive of no profit. Ricardo, Principles of Political Economy. End of footnote. Just as little can it originate in the second act of circulation, the resale of the commodity, which does no more than transform the article from its bodily form back again into its money form. The change must, therefore, take place in the commodity bought by the first act, money to commodity, but not in its value, for equivalents are exchanged, and the commodity is paid for at its full value. We are, therefore, forced to the conclusion that the change originates in the use value, as such, of the commodity, that is, in its consumption. In order to be able to extract value from the consumption of a commodity, our friend Moneybags must be so lucky as to find within the sphere of circulation, in the market, a commodity whose use value possesses the peculiar property of being a source of value, whose actual consumption, therefore, is itself an embodiment of labour, and consequently a creation of value. The possessor of money does find on the market such a special commodity in capacity for labour, or labour power. By labour power, or capacity for labour, is to be understood the aggregate of those mental and physical capabilities existing in a human being, which he exercises whenever he produces a use value of any description. But in order that our owner of money may be able to find labour power offered for sale as a commodity, various conditions must first be fulfilled. The exchange of commodities of itself implies no other relations of dependence than those which result from its own nature. On this assumption, labour power can appear upon the market as a commodity only if, and so far as, its possessor, the individual whose labour power it is, offers it for sale, or sells it, as a commodity. In order that he may be able to do this, he must have it at his disposal, must be the untrammelled owner of his capacity for labour, that is, of his person. Footnote. In encyclopedias of classical antiquities we find nonsense such as this, that in the ancient world capital was fully developed, quote, except that the free labourer and a system of credit was wanting. Unquote. Mommsen also, in his History of Rome, commits, in this respect, one blunder after another. End of footnote. He and the owner of money meet in the market, and deal with each other as on the basis of equal rights, with this difference alone, that one is the buyer, the other seller. Both, therefore, equal in the eyes of the law. The continuance of this relation demands that the owner of the labour power should sell it only for a definite period, for if he were to sell it rump and stump, once for all, he would be selling himself, converting himself from a free man into a slave, from an owner of a commodity into a commodity. He must constantly look upon his labour power as his own property, his own commodity, and this he can only do by placing it at the disposal of the buyer temporarily, for a definite period of time. By this means alone can he avoid renouncing his rights of ownership over it. Footnote. Hence, legislation in various countries fixes a maximum for labour contracts. Wherever free labour is the rule, the laws regulate the mode of terminating this contract. In some states, particularly in Mexico, before the American Civil War, also in the territories taken from Mexico, and also, as a matter of fact, in the Danubian provinces till the revolution effected by Cusa, slavery is hidden under the form of peonage. By means of advances repayable in labour, which are handed down from generation to generation, not only the individual labourer, but his family become de facto the property of other persons and their families. Juarez abolished peonage. The so-called Emperor Maximilian re-established it by a decree, which, in the House of Representatives at Washington, was aptly denounced as a decree for the reintroduction of slavery into Mexico. I may make over to another the use for a limited time of my particular bodily and mental aptitudes and capabilities, because in consequence of this restriction they are impressed with a character of alienation with regard to me as a whole, but by the alienation of all my labour time and the whole of my work, I should be converting the substance itself, in other words, my general activity and reality, my person, into the property of another. Hegel, Philosophie des Rechts, Berlin, 1840. End of footnote. The second essential condition to the owner of money finding labour power in the market as a commodity is this, that the labourer, instead of being in the position to sell commodities in which his labour is incorporated, must be obliged to offer for sale as a commodity that very labour power which exists only in his living self. In order that a man may be able to sell commodities other than labour power, he must, of course, have the means of production, as raw material, implements, etc. No boots can be made without leather. He requires also the means of subsistence. Nobody, not even a musician of the future, can live upon future products or upon use values in an unfinished state. And ever since the first moment of his appearance on the world stage, man has always been, and must still be, a consumer both before and while he is producing. In a society where all products assume the form of commodities, these commodities must be sold after they have been produced. It is only after their sale that they can serve in satisfying the requirements of their producer. The time necessary for their sale is superadded to that necessary for their production. For the conversion of his money into capital, therefore, the owner of money must meet in the market with the free labourer. Free in the double sense, that as a free man he can dispose of his labour power as his own commodity, and that on the other hand he has no other commodity for sale, is short of everything necessary for the realisation of his labour power. The question why this free labourer confronts him in the market has no interest for the owner of money, who regards the labour market as a branch of the general market for commodities. And for the present, it interests us just as little. We cling to the fact theoretically as he does practically. One thing, however, is clear. Nature does not produce on the one side owners of money or commodities, and on the other, men possessing nothing but their own labour power. This relation has no natural basis, neither is its social basis one that is common to all historical periods. It is clearly the result of a past historical development, the product of many economic revolutions, of the extinction of a whole series of older forms of social production. So, too, the economic categories already discussed by us bear the stamp of history. Definite historical conditions are necessary that a product may become a commodity. It must not be produced as the immediate means of subsistence of the producer himself. Had we gone further, and inquired under what circumstances all or even the majority of products take the form of commodities, we should have found that this can only happen with production of a very specific kind, capitalist production. Such an inquiry, however, would have been foreign to the analysis of commodities. Production and circulation of commodities can take place, although the great mass of the objects produced are intended for the immediate requirements of their producers, are not turned into commodities, and consequently social production is not yet by a long way dominated in its length and breadth by exchange value. The appearance of products as commodities presupposes such a development of the social division of labour that the separation of use value from exchange value, a separation which first begins with barter, must already have been completed. But such a degree of development is common to many forms of society, which in other respects present the most varying historical features. On the one hand, if we consider money, its existence implies a definite stage in the exchange of commodities. The particular functions of money which it performs, either as the mere equivalent of commodities or as a means of circulation or means of payment, as hoard or as universal money, point, according to the extent and relative preponderance of the one function or the other, to very different stages in the process of social production. Yet we know by experience that a circulation of commodities, relatively primitive, suffices for the production of all these forms, otherwise with capital. The historical conditions of its existence are by no means given with the mere circulation of money and commodities. It can spring into life only when the owner of the means of production and subsistence meets in the market with the free labourer selling his labour power. And this one historical condition comprises a world's history. Capital, therefore, announces from its first appearance a new epoch in the process of social production. Footnote. The capitalist epoch is therefore characterized by this: that labor power takes, in the eyes of the laborer himself, the form of a commodity which is his property. His labor, consequently, becomes wage labor. On the other hand, it is only from this moment that the produce of labour universally becomes a commodity. End of footnote. We must now examine more closely this peculiar commodity, labour power. Like all others, it has a value. Footnote. The value or worth of a man is, as of all other things, his price. That is to say, so much as would be given for the use of his power. Thomas Hobbes, Leviathan, in Works, 1839-44. How is that value determined? The value of labour power is determined, as in the case of every other commodity, by the labour time necessary for the production, and consequently also the reproduction, of this special article. So far as it has value, it represents no more than a definite quantity of the average labour of society incorporated in it. Labour power exists only as a capacity, or power, of the living individual. Its production consequently presupposes his existence. Given the individual, the production of labour power consists in his reproduction of himself, or his maintenance. For his maintenance, he requires a given quantity of the means of subsistence. Therefore, the labour time requisite for the production of labour power reduces itself to that necessary for the production of those means of subsistence. In other words, the value of labour power is the value of the means of subsistence necessary for the maintenance of the labourer. Labour power, however, becomes a reality only by its exercise. It sets itself in action only by working. But thereby a definite quantity of human muscle, nerve, brain, etc. is wasted, and these require to be restored. This increased expenditure demands a larger income. Footnote. Hence the Roman Villicus, as overlooker of the agricultural slaves, received, quote, more meager fare than working slaves, because his work was lighter, unquote. Theodor Mommsen, Römische Geschichte, 1856. End of footnote. If the owner of labour power works today, tomorrow he must again be able to repeat the same process in the same conditions as regards health and strength. His means of subsistence must therefore be sufficient to maintain him in his normal state as a labouring individual. His natural wants, such as food, clothing, fuel and housing, vary according to the climatic and other physical conditions of his country. On the other hand, the number and extent of his so-called necessary wants, as also the modes of satisfying them, are themselves the product of historical development, and depend therefore to a great extent on the degree of civilization of a country, more particularly on the conditions under which, and consequently on the habits and degree of comfort in which, the class of free labourers has been formed. Footnote. Compare William Thomas Thornton. Overpopulation and its Remedy. London, 1846. End of footnote. In contradistinction, therefore, to the case of other commodities, there enters into the determination of the value of labour power a historical and moral element. Nevertheless, in a given country, at a given period, the average quantity of the means of subsistence necessary for the labourer is practically known. The owner of labour power is mortal. If, then, his appearance in the market is to be continuous, and the continuous conversion of money into capital assumes this, the seller of labour power must perpetuate himself in the way that every living individual perpetuates himself by procreation. William Petty. The labour power withdrawn from the market by wear and tear and death must be continually replaced by, at the very least, an equal amount of fresh labour power. Hence the sum of the means of subsistence necessary for the production of labour power must include the means necessary for the labourer's substitutes, that is, his children, in order that this race of peculiar commodity owners may perpetuate its appearance in the market. Footnote. Labour's natural price consists in such a quantity of necessaries and comforts of life as, from the nature of the climate and the habits of the country, are necessary to support the labourer and to enable him to rear such a family as may preserve, in the market, an undiminished supply of labour. End of footnote. In order to modify the human organism so that it may acquire skill and handiness in a given branch of industry, and become labour power of a special kind, a special education or training is requisite, and this, on its part, costs an equivalent in commodities of a greater or less amount. This amount varies according to the more or less complicated character of the labour power. The expenses of this education, excessively small in the case of ordinary labour power, enter pro tanto into the total value spent in its production. The value of labour power resolves itself into the value of a definite quantity of the means of subsistence. It therefore varies with the value of these means, or with the quantity of labour requisite for their production. Some of the means of subsistence, such as food and fuel, are consumed daily, and a fresh supply must be provided daily. Others, such as clothes and furniture, last for longer periods and require to be replaced only at longer intervals. One article must be bought or paid for daily, another weekly, another quarterly, and so on, But in whatever way the sum total of these outlays may be spread over the year, they must be covered by the average income, taking one day with another. If the total of the commodities required daily for the production of labour power equals A, and those required weekly equals B, and those required quarterly equals C, and so on, the daily average of these commodities equals 365A plus 52B plus 4C plus etc. over 365. Suppose that in this mass of commodities requisite for the average day there are embodied 6 hours of social labour. Then there is incorporated daily in labour power half a day's average social labour. In other words, half a day's labour is requisite for the daily production of labour power. This quantity of labour forms the value of a day's labour power, or the value of the labour power daily reproduced. If half a day's average social labour is incorporated in 3 shillings, then 3 shillings is the price corresponding to the value of a day's labour power. If its owner, therefore, offers it for sale at 3 shillings a day, its selling price is equal to its value, and according to our supposition, our friend Moneybags, who is intent upon converting his 3 shillings into capital, pays this value. The minimum limit of the value of labour power is determined by the value of the commodities without the daily supply of which the labourer cannot renew his vital energy. Consequently, by the value of those means of subsistence that are physically indispensable. If the price of labour power falls to this minimum, it falls below its value, since under such circumstances it can be maintained and developed only in a crippled state. But the value of every commodity is determined by the labour time requisite to turn it out, so as to be of normal quality. It is a very cheap sort of sentimentality which declares this method of determining the value of labour power, a method prescribed by the very nature of the case, to be a brutal method, and which wails with Rossi that, to comprehend capacity for labour, puissance de travail, at the same time that we make abstraction from the means of subsistence of the labourers during the process of production, is to comprehend a phantom. When we speak of labour, or capacity for labour, we speak at the same time of the labourer and his means of subsistence, of labourer and wages. Footnote. Rossi. Cours d'économie politique. Brussels, 1842. End of footnote. When we speak of capacity for labour, we do not speak of labour any more than when we speak of capacity for digestion, we speak of digestion. The latter process requires something more than a good stomach. When we speak of capacity for labour, we do not abstract from the necessary means of subsistence. On the contrary, their value is expressed in its value. If his capacity for labour remains unsold, the labourer derives no benefit from it, but rather he will feel it to be a cruel, nature-imposed necessity that this capacity has cost for its production a definite amount of the means of subsistence, and that it will continue to do so for its reproduction. He will then agree with Sismondi that capacity for labour is nothing unless it is sold. Footnote. Sismondi. Nouveau principe d'économie politique. End of footnote. One consequence of the peculiar nature of labour power as a commodity is that its use value does not, on the conclusion of the contract between the buyer and seller, immediately pass into the hands of the former. Its value, like that of every other commodity, is already fixed before it goes into circulation, since a definite quantity of social labour has been spent upon it. But its use value consists in the subsequent exercise of its force. The alienation of labour power and its actual appropriation by the buyer, its employment as a use value, are separated by an interval of time. But in those cases in which the formal alienation by sale of the use value of a commodity is not simultaneous with its actual delivery to the buyer. The money of the latter usually functions as a means of payment. Footnote. All labour is paid after it has ceased. An inquiry into those principles respecting the nature of demand, etc. The system of commercial credit had to start at the moment when the labourer, the prime creator of products, could, thanks to his savings, wait for his wages until the end of the week. Charles Gagny, Des Systèmes d'Économie Politique, end of footnote. In every country in which the capitalist mode of production reigns, it is the custom not to pay for labour power before it has been exercised for the period fixed by the contract, as, for example, the end of each week. In all cases, therefore, the use value of the labour power is advanced to the capitalist. The labourer allows the buyer to consume it before he receives payment of the price. He everywhere gives credit to the capitalist. That this credit is no mere fiction is shown not only by the occasional loss of wages on the bankruptcy of the capitalist. Footnote. The labourer lends his industry, but, adds Storch slyly, he risks nothing except the loss of his wages. The labourer does not hand over anything of a material nature. Storch. Cours d'économie politique. End of footnote. But also by a series of more enduring consequences. Footnote. One example. In London there are two sorts of bakers, the full-priced, who sell bread at its full value, and the undersellers, who sell it under its value. The latter class comprises more than three-fourths of the total number of bakers. Report of H.S. Tremenheer, Commissioner to examine into the grievances complained of by the journeyman bakers, etc., London, 1862. The undersellers, almost without exception, sell bread adulterated with alum, soap, pearl ashes, chalk, Derbyshire stone dust, and such like agreeable, nourishing, and wholesome ingredients. See the above cited Blue Book, as also the report of the Committee of 1855 on the Adulteration of Bread, and Dr. Hassell's Adulterations Detected, 1861. Sir John Gordon stated before the Committee of 1855 that, in consequence of these adulterations, the poor man, who lives on 2 pounds of bread a day, does not now get 1/4 part of nourishing matter, let alone the deleterious effects on his health. Tremenheer states, as the reason why a very large part of the working class, although well aware of this adulteration, nevertheless accept the alum, stone dust, etc., as part of their purchase, that it is for them a matter of necessity to take from their baker or from the chandler's shop such bread as they choose to supply. As they are not paid their wages before the end of the week, they in turn are unable to pay for the bread consumed by their families during the week before the end of the week. And Tremenheer adds on the evidence of witnesses, "It is notorious that bread composed of those mixtures is made expressly for sale in this manner." In many English and still more Scotch agricultural districts, wages are paid fortnightly, and even monthly. With such long intervals between the payments, the agricultural labourer is obliged to buy on credit. He must pay higher prices, and is in fact tied to the shop which gives him credit. Thus at Horningham in Wilts, for example, where the wages are monthly, the same flour that he could buy elsewhere at 1 and 10 pence per stone costs him 2 and 4 pence per stone. Sixth Report on Public Health by the Medical Officer of the Privy Council, etc., 1864. Quote, "The block printers of Paisley and Kilmarnock enforced by a strike fortnightly instead of monthly payment of wages." Unquote. Reports of the Inspectors of Factories, for 31st of October 1853. As a further pretty result of the credit given by the workmen to the capitalist, we may refer to the method current in many English coal mines, where the labourer is not paid till the end of the month, and in the meantime receives sums on account from the capitalist, often in goods for which the miner is obliged to pay more than the market price. Truck system. It is a common practice with the coal masters to pay once a month, and advance cash to their workmen at the end of each intermediate week. The cash is given in the shop, that is, the tommy shop which belongs to the master. The men take it on one side and lay it out on the other. Children's Employment Commission, 1864. Nevertheless, whether money serves as a means of purchase or as a means of payment, this makes no alteration in the nature of the exchange of commodities. The price of the labour power is fixed by the contract, although it is not realised till later, like the rent of a house. The labour power is sold, although it is only paid for at a later period. It will, therefore, be useful for a clear comprehension of the relation of the parties to assume provisionally that the possessor of labour power, on the occasion of each sale, immediately receives the price stipulated to be paid for it. We now know how the value paid by the purchaser to the possessor of this peculiar commodity, labour power, is determined. The use value which the former gets in exchange manifests itself only in the actual utilisation, in the consumption of the labour power. The money owner buys everything necessary for this purpose, such as raw material, in the market, and pays for it at its full value. The consumption of labour power is at one and the same time the production of commodities and of surplus value. The consumption of labour power is completed, as in the case of every other commodity, outside the limits of the market or of the sphere of circulation. Accompanied by Mr. Moneybags and by the possessor of labour power, we therefore take leave for a time of this noisy sphere, where everything takes place on the surface and in view of all men, and follow them both into the hidden abode of production, on whose threshold there stares us in the face, "No admittance, except on business." Here we shall see not only how capital produces, but how capital is produced. We shall at last force the secret of profit-making. This sphere that we are deserting, within whose boundaries the sale and purchase of labour power goes on, is in fact a very Eden of the innate rights of man. There alone rule freedom, equality, property, and Bentham. Freedom, because both buyer and seller of a commodity, say of labour power, are constrained only by their own free will. They contract as free agents, and the agreement they come to is but the form in which they give legal expression to their common will. Equality, because each enters into relation with the other, as with a simple owner of commodities, and they exchange equivalent for equivalent. Property, because each disposes only of what is his own. And Bentham, because each looks only to himself, the only force that brings them together and puts them in relation with each other is the selfishness, the gain, and the private interests of each. Each looks to himself only, and no one troubles himself about the rest. And just because they do so, do they all, in accordance with the pre-established harmony of things, or under the auspices of an all-shrewd providence, work together to their mutual advantage, for the common weal, and in the interest of all. On leaving this sphere of simple circulation, or of exchange of commodities, which furnishes the free trader vulgaris with his views and ideas, and with the standard by which he judges a society based on capital and wages, we think we can perceive a change in the physiognomy of our dramatis personae. He, who before was the money owner, now strides in front as capitalist. The possessor of labour power follows as his labourer. The one with an air of importance, smirking, intent on business. The other timid and holding back, like one who is bringing his own hide to market, and has nothing to expect but a hiding. Part 3. The Production of Absolute Surplus Value. Chapter 7. The Labour Process and the Process of Producing Surplus Value. Section 1. The Labour Process, or the Production of Use Values. The capitalist buys labour power in order to use it, and labour power, in use, is labour itself. The purchaser of labour power consumes it by setting the seller of it to work. By working, the latter becomes actually what before he only was potentially, labour power in action, a labourer. In order that his labour may reappear in a commodity, he must, before all things, expend it on something useful, on something capable of satisfying a want of some sort. Hence, what the capitalist sets the labourer to produce is a particular use-value, a specified article. The fact that the production of use-values, or goods, is carried on under the control of a capitalist and on his behalf does not alter the general character of that production. We shall, therefore, in the first place, have to consider the labour process independently of the particular form it assumes under given social conditions. Labour is, in the first place, a process in which both man and nature participate, and in which man, of his own accord, starts, regulates, and controls the material reactions between himself and nature. He opposes himself to nature as one of her own forces, setting in motion arms and legs, head and hands, the natural forces of his body, in order to appropriate nature's productions in a form adapted to his own wants. By thus acting on the external world and changing it, he at the same time changes his own nature. He develops his slumbering powers and compels them to act in obedience to his sway. We are not now dealing with those primitive instinctive forms of labour that remind us of the mere animal. An immeasurable interval of time separates the state of things in which a man brings his labour power to market for sale as a commodity from that state in which human labour was still in its first instinctive stage. We presuppose labour in a form that stamps it as exclusively human. A spider conducts operations that resemble those of a weaver, and a bee puts to shame many an architect in the construction of her cells. But what distinguishes the worst architect from the best of bees is this, that the architect raises his structure in imagination before he erects it in reality. At the end of every labour process, we get a result that already existed in the imagination of the labourer at its commencement. He not only effects a change of form in the material on which he works, but he also realises a purpose of his own that gives the law to his modus operandi, and to which he must subordinate his will. And this subordination is no mere momentary act. Besides the exertion of the bodily organs, the process demands that, during the whole operation, the workman's will be steadily in consonance with his purpose. This means close attention. The less he is attracted by the nature of the work and the mode in which it is carried on, and the less, therefore, he enjoys it as something which gives play to his bodily and mental powers, the more close his attention is forced to be. The elementary factors of the labour process are, 1, the personal activity of man, that is, work itself, 2, the subject of that work, and 3, its instruments. The soil, and this, economically speaking, includes water, in the virgin state in which it supplies man with the necessaries or the means of subsistence, ready to hand, exists independently of him, and is the universal subject of human labour. Footnote. The earth's spontaneous productions being in small quantity and quite independent of man appear, as it were, to be furnished by nature in the same way as a small sum is given to a young man in order to put him in a way of industry and of making his fortune. James Stewart, Principles of Political Economy, Dublin, 1770. End of footnote. All those things which labour merely separates from immediate connection with their environment are subjects of labour spontaneously provided by nature. Such are fish which we catch and take from their element, water, timber which we fell in the virgin forest, and ores which we extract from their veins. If, on the other hand, the subject of labour has, so to say, been filtered through previous labour, we call it raw material. Such is ore already extracted and ready for washing. All raw material is the subject of labour, but not every subject of labour is raw material. It can only become so after it has undergone some alteration by means of labour. An instrument of labour is a thing, or a complex of things, which the labourer interposes between himself and the subject of his labour, and which serves as the conductor of his activity. He makes use of the mechanical, physical, and chemical properties of some substances in order to make other substances subservient to his aims. Footnote. Reason is just as cunning as she is powerful. Her cunning consists principally in her mediating activity, which, by causing objects to act and react on each other in accordance with their own nature in this way, without any direct interference in the process, carries out reason's intentions. Hegel, Berlin, 1840. End of footnote. Leaving out of consideration such ready-made means of subsistence as fruits, in gathering which a man's own limbs serve as the instruments of his labour, the first thing of which the labourer possesses himself is not the subject of labour, but its instrument. Thus, nature becomes one of the organs of his activity, one that he annexes to his own bodily organs, adding stature to himself in spite of the Bible. As the earth is his original larder, so too it is his original tool-house. It supplies him, for instance, with stones for throwing, grinding, pressing, cutting, etc. The earth itself is an instrument of labour, but when used as such in agriculture implies a whole series of other instruments, and a comparatively high development of labour. Footnote. In his otherwise miserable work, Théorie de l'économie politique, Paris, 1815, Ganil enumerates in a striking manner, in opposition to the physiocrats, the long series of previous processes necessary before agriculture, properly so called, can commence. End of footnote. No sooner does labour undergo the least development than it requires specially prepared instruments. Thus, in the oldest caves we find stone implements and weapons. In the earliest period of human history, domesticated animals, that is, animals which have been bred for the purpose and have undergone modifications by means of labour, play the chief part as instruments of labour along with specially prepared stones, wood, bones, and shells. Footnote. Turgot, in his Réflexions sur la formation et la distribution des richesses, 1766, brings well into prominence the importance of domesticated animals to early civilization. End of footnote. The use and fabrication of instruments of labour, although existing in the germ among certain species of animals, is specifically characteristic of the human labour process, and Franklin therefore defines man as a tool-making animal. Relics of bygone instruments of labour possess the same importance for the investigation of extinct economic forms of society as do fossil bones for the determination of extinct species of animals. It is not the articles made, but how they are made and by what instruments, that enables us to distinguish different economic epochs. Footnote: the least important commodities of all for the technological comparison of different epochs of production are articles of luxury, in the strict meaning of the term. However little our written histories up to this time notice the development of material production, which is the basis of all social life and therefore of all history, yet prehistoric times have been classified in accordance with the results, not of so-called historical, but of materialistic investigations. These periods have been divided to correspond with the materials from which their implements and weapons were made, viz. Into the stone, the bronze, and the iron ages. End of footnote. Instruments of labour not only supply a standard of the degree of development to which human labour has attained, but they are also indicators of the social conditions under which that labour is carried on. Among the instruments of labour, those of a mechanical nature which, taken as a whole, we may call the bone and muscles of production, offer much more decided characteristics of a given epoch of production than those which, like pipes, tubs, baskets, jars, etc., serve only to hold the materials for labour, which latter class we may in a general way call the vascular system of production. The latter first begins to play an important part in the chemical industries. In a wider sense, we may include among the instruments of labour, in addition to those things that are used for directly transferring labour to its subject and which therefore, in one way or another, serve as conductors of activity, all such objects as are necessary for carrying on the labour process. These do not enter directly into the process, but without them it is either impossible for it to take place at all, or possible only to a partial extent. Once more we find the earth to be a universal instrument of this sort, for it furnishes a locus standi to the labourer and a field of employment for his activity. Among instruments that are the result of previous labour and also belong to this class, we find workshops, canals, roads, and so forth. In the labour process, therefore, man's activity, with the help of the instruments of labour, effects an alteration, designed from the commencement, in the material worked upon. The process disappears in the product. The latter is a use value. Nature's material adapted by a change of form to the wants of man. Labour has incorporated itself with its subject. The former is materialized, the latter transformed. That which in the labourer appeared as movement now appears in the product as a fixed quality without motion. The blacksmith forges, and the product is a forging. If we examine the whole process from the point of view of its result, the product, it is plain that both the instruments and the subject of labour are means of production. Footnote: it appears paradoxical to assert that uncaught fish, for instance, are a means of production in the fishing industry. But hitherto no one has discovered the art of catching fish in waters that contain none. End of footnote. And that the labour itself is productive labour. Footnote: this method of determining, from the standpoint of the labour process alone, what is productive labour, is by no means directly applicable to the case of the capitalist process of production. End of footnote. Though a use value in the form of a product issues from the labour process, yet other use values, products of previous labour, enter into it as means of production. The same use value is both the product of a previous process and a means of production in a later process. Products are therefore not only results, but also essential conditions of labour. With the exception of the extractive industries, in which the material for labour is provided immediately by nature, such as mining, hunting, fishing, and agriculture, so far as the latter is confined to breaking up virgin soil, all branches of industry manipulate raw material, objects already filtered through labour, already products of labour. Such is seed in agriculture. Animals and plants, which we are accustomed to consider as products of nature, are, in their present form, not only products of, say, last year's labour, but the result of a gradual transformation, continued through many generations under man's superintendence and by means of his labour. But in the great majority of cases, instruments of labour show even to the most superficial observer traces of the labour of past ages. Raw material may either form the principal substance of a product, or it may enter into its formation only as necessary. An accessory may be consumed by the instruments of labour, as coal under a boiler, oil by a wheel, hay by draft horses, or it may be mixed with the raw material in order to produce some modification thereof, as chlorine into unbleached linen, coal with iron, dyestuff with wool, or again, it may help to carry on the work itself, as in the case of the materials used for heating and lighting workshops. The distinction between principal substance and accessory vanishes in the true chemical industries, because there none of the raw material reappears in its original composition in the substance of the product. Footnote. Storch calls true raw materials matière, and accessory material matériau. Cherbuliez describes accessories as matière instrumentale. End of footnote. Every object possesses various properties, and is thus capable of being applied to different uses. One and the same product may therefore serve as raw material in very different processes. Corn, for example, is a raw material for millers, starch manufacturers, distillers, and cattle breeders. It also enters as raw material into its own production, in the shape of seed. Coal, too, is at the same time the product of, and a means of production in, coal mining. Again, a particular product may be used in one and the same process, both as an instrument of labour and as a raw material. Take, for instance, the fattening of cattle, where the animal is the raw material and at the same time an instrument for the production of manure. A product, though ready for immediate consumption, may yet serve as raw material for a further product, as grapes when they become the raw material for wine. On the other hand, labour may give us its product in such a form that we can use it only as a raw material, as is the case with cotton, thread, and yarn. Such a raw material, though itself a product, may have to go through a whole series of different processes. In each of these, in turn, it serves, with constantly varying form, as raw material, until the last process of the series leaves it a perfect product, ready for individual consumption, or for use as an instrument of labour. Hence we see that whether a use value is to be regarded as raw material, as instrument of labour, or as product, this is determined entirely by its function in the labour process, by the position it there occupies. As this varies, so does its character. Whenever, therefore, a product enters as a means of production into a new labour process, it thereby loses its character of product, and becomes a mere factor in the process. A spinner treats spindles only as implements for spinning, and flax only as the material that he spins. Of course, it is impossible to spin without material and spindles, and therefore the existence of these things as products at the commencement of the spinning operation must be presumed. But in the process itself, the fact that they are products of previous labour is a matter of utter indifference, just as in the digestive process it is of no importance whatever that bread is the produce of the previous labour of the farmer, the miller, and the baker. On the contrary, it is generally by their imperfections as products that the means of production in any process assert themselves in their character of products. A blunt knife or weak thread forcibly remind us of Mr. A. the cutler or Mr. B. the spinner. In the finished product, the labour, by means of which it has acquired its useful qualities, is not palpable, has apparently vanished. A machine which does not serve the purposes of labour is useless. In addition, it falls a prey to the destructive influence of natural forces. Iron rusts and wood rots. Yarn, with which we neither weave nor knit, is cotton wasted. Living labour must seize upon these things and rouse them from their death sleep, change them from mere possible use values into real and effective ones. Bathed in the fire of labour, appropriated as part and parcel of labour's organism, and as it were made alive for the performance of their functions in the process, they are in truth consumed, but consumed with a purpose, as elementary constituents of new use-values, of new products, ever ready as means of subsistence for individual consumption, or as means of production for some new labour process. If, then, on the one hand, finished products are not only results, but also necessary conditions of the labour process, on the other hand, their assumption into that process, their contact with living labour, is the sole means by which they can be made to retain their character of use values and be utilised. Labour uses up its material factors, its subject and its instruments, consumes them, and is therefore a process of consumption. Such productive consumption is distinguished from individual consumption by this, that the latter uses up products as means of subsistence for the living individual, the former as means whereby alone labour, the labour power of the living individual, is enabled to act. The product, therefore, of individual consumption is the consumer himself. The result of productive consumption is a product distinct from the consumer. Insofar, then, as its instruments and subjects are themselves products, labour consumes products in order to create products, or in other words, consumes one set of products by turning them into means of production for another set. But just as in the beginning the only participators in the labour process were man and earth, which latter exists independently of man, so even now we still employ in the process many means of production provided directly by nature that do not represent any combination of natural substances with human labour. The labour process, resolved, as above, into its simple elementary factors, is human action with a view to the production of use values, appropriation of natural substances to human requirements. It is the necessary condition for effecting exchange of matter between man and nature. It is the everlasting, nature-imposed condition of human existence, and therefore is independent of every social phase of that existence, or rather is common to every such phase. It was, therefore, not necessary to represent our labourer in connection with other labourers. Man and his labour on one side, nature and its materials on the other, sufficed. As the taste of porridge does not tell you who grew the oats, no more does this simple process tell you of itself what are the social conditions under which it is taking place, whether under the slave owner's brutal lash or the anxious eye of the capitalist, whether Cincinnatus carries it on in tilling his modest farm, or a savage in killing wild animals with stones. Footnote. By a wonderful feat of logical acumen, Colonel Torrens has discovered in this stone of the savage the origin of capital. Quote, "In the first stone which the savage flings at the wild animal he pursues, in the first stick that he seizes to strike down the fruit which hangs above his reach, we see the appropriation of one article for the purpose of aiding in the acquisition of another, and thus discover the origin of capital." Unquote. R. Torrens, An Essay on the Production of Wealth, etc. End of footnote. Let us now return to our would-be capitalist. We left him just after he had purchased, in the open market, all the necessary factors of the labour process, its objective factors,